Hello, everybody. This is Craig D. Lindsay, a.k.a. Uncle Krizzle, a.k.a. Black Larry David, a.k.a. Anastasia Beaverhausen, a.k.a. Tavis Not-So-Smiley, a.k.a. Cranky Charlie Rose, a.k.a. a bunch of names and so forth. And welcome to Motherfuckers I Know, the podcast where I talk to motherfuckers I know. Because, hey, you know, I'm at the house, not doing much, so I figured, hey, I'll just talk to somebody. And here with me today is a very well-known film writer, film critic, and film programmer, and actually is had many experiences. He's, of course, you know, involving film, not just writing about film, but also making film and programming film, and actually has a video store now where he gets people to rent films. So it's just, you know, that's just one of the many things we'll be talking about. So let me introduce him. Aaron Hillis, welcome to the Krizzlecast.
Thanks for having me, Craig.
All right. Well, you know, just before we start anything, you know, just as always, I like to go online and just see, you know, if there's any more stuff I can get to, you know, for a filler in order, you know, for in order to talk during this podcast. Just going on your Twitter page and. Just, you know, it's funny, cause, just seeing, out of all the things I'd expect you to write about, you mentioned that you did a 2,000-word piece about Paul Dini.
That's true, yes. I was asked by a PR firm who works for the Stevenson School, which is a boarding school out in Pebble Beach, California, and Paul Dini was a graduate there. He spent a few years in his high school days in the 70s, and fell upon me. I was quite familiar with Dini's work, so it was a pretty exciting opportunity to be able to do a profile on him about his life and career and his days at Stevenson.
Yeah, it's funny because I didn't, you know, I know of Paul Dini because I believe he used to work on Tiny Toon Adventures back in the day.
That's true.
And I didn't know basically about just the gamut of work he's done in animation, and so just, you know, didn't what was this for again?
It's for the Stevenson School Alumni Magazine.
Oh, really? Yeah. So you guess was a. I mean, it's why. I mean, was it kind of like they just sought you because you knew this kind of stuff, or just like you work for this firm, or you do things like that?
Actually, it's one of my good friends and colleagues, Peter DeBruges, who's worked for the same alumni mag. And Peter was actually too busy. He's a critic and feature writer for Variety.
Yeah.
And was just too busy to do a piece. So when they asked him for a recommendation, Peter was kind enough to mention my name to them.
Wow. So. Yeah, it's great to have friends in high places, isn't it? I wish. You know, funny thing, I do have friends in high places, and yet, you know, here I am. I'm still, you know, doing stuff in Raleigh. But yeah, just as always, when I talk to people like yourself who seem to have his foot in so many things, it's kind of difficult to where to start at first. Well, I mean, we can go into your store, your video store, Video Free Brooklyn, in Brooklyn. Just voted the best video store in New York City by Village Voice last year, I believe.
Yeah, we got some nice attention. Village Voice and Time Out New York. And most recently, the Elle magazine have all given us some top honors.
Is that still a thing to compete for in New York City video stores?
Yeah, well, I guess it is. There is something of a backhanded compliment, only because they are a dying breed in general. But I think what we're trying to do at Beauty Free Brooklyn is a little bit different and a little more. I won't say evolved, but just more modern, more in tune with what the current marketplace is.
And what would you say is what you're doing that would you say is different?
Well, I think first and foremost, the store has really tied in a lot to my film career in different capacities, and as a programmer and film journalist, I have maintained a lot of relationships with distributors and filmmakers, and that's helped sometimes keep overhead down because I've got good relationships with companies who are willing to give me the same wholesale cost that they would a large company. And I think it also helps me to just in having a better sense of what to put into the store. There are so many, there are dozens of DVDs that and Blu-rays that come out every single week, but not all of them are necessarily worth having. So really, it's a combination of trying to see, seeking my own taste, and I think I have a lot of like-minded customers, as well as just trying to figure out what people in my media-savvy neighborhood are going to be into. I think it's a lot like the vinyl stores is the comparison I always make. You can't get every record, but if you've got some cool ones, then people will be a following.
Well, it kind of makes me think what has been the reaction you've gotten from people who frequent this operation. I'm sure, since it's a video store, you get people asking for all kinds of things to see if you have. I mean, what have been? I'm trying to think if there have been the major disappointments you've had to bestow on people when they come in asking for a certain title.
I think the major disappointments are when people ask for things ask for discs that are unfortunately out of print or have never had a Region 1 DVD, because then I know that I'm just not going to be able to have it in the store. Mm-hmm. Kim's Video, a very, very popular store, used to get everything. They used to get all sorts of multi-region stuff, and it just doesn't really make sense for what we're going on. I'd rather use my budget for things that I know a wider array of people are going to be able to use, since not everyone has a multi-region player. And there's specialty, and then there's limited audience, and there's certainly a big distinction between the two. I've certainly been embracing Blu-ray. I think it's been the biggest thing. And if I say there's any major disappointment aside from not being able to get certain titles in, it's that more people haven't made the switch yet. I think a lot of people are still unsure. Don't know that both Blu-ray doesn't cost a whole lot, and that the format war has ended, and there really isn't going to be anything past Blu-ray in the immediate future.
I mean, well, yeah. So I mean, just I'm trying to see if is it mostly Blu-ray DVDs, or just is it completely Blu-ray DVDs that you have, or
no? I mean, my clientele that only about 5% or so are actually using Blu-ray.
Yeah.
And so I really try to really curate that section to make sure that I'm getting things that are going to be extraordinary, not just new releases, and not just going to be not just going to be popular on a new release shelf for a couple months and then die off. We're mostly DVD, I'd say most everything I get, I try to get on DVD. There are a few things that I do have on Blu-ray that are exclusive to that format, but I tend to favor DVD when possible.
That's right. I'm looking at the photo of your store on your website, the Video Free Brooklyn website. I mean, it appears to be quite a small place, and just, kind of, it does make me wonder, like, can you house a lot of videos? I mean, from the way you're talking, it is kind of like you only have limited space to provide all these titles that you have in grass? I mean, just as, I mean, would you say, like, I'm just saying, is it as small as I think it is from looking at it?
It's even smaller. No, it's 375 square feet, which is, you know, arguably not a lot of space, but it's absolutely enough for what we need to do. I mean, I haven't had to move anything out yet. We're at about 6,500 titles, and you know, within that, here's how it's going to work. I mean, since this is going to be a curated space, we're going to start with the basement, and basically, we're going to be able to grow the library. But you know, some titles maybe they're not necessarily in vogue. But I'm not going to get rid of something. I mean, Fort Apache the Bronx is not flying off the shelves. They'll be damned if I get rid of that title or sell it off. So there will be certain movies that will end up in the basement, and through the computer, you know, we'll be able to still have them. So it may not be, you know, we may not have it right now, but we can have it in 2 hours for you or tomorrow. And I think that'll allow us to really build the place. So it doesn't really matter what the size of the shop is. There's going to be an ever-rotating crop of things in there. I mean, one of the things that always bothered me about video stores is that the new releases tend to have to be back quicker than something in a catalog inventory. Mm-hmm. And I've seen that plenty of video stores, you know, whether they be mom-and-pop shops or whether they be Blockbusters, will have new releases that sit on that shelf for well over a year, you know, the things that are no longer new releases. Whereas at our shop, 8 weeks, man, 6 to 8 weeks, and then you're in catalog. Mm. So we like to really keep things fresh and keep things rotating so that, you know, even if you only came in once a week, there's always going to be a plethora of new and exciting things to look at.
It's always interesting when you embark on a video store with a basement. There was a video store in Chapel Hill, not too far from where I live, where they, you know, I went in there once and went down there, and they did have the basement with a lot of other titles and even VHS stuff. So it's always weird that you didn't make that journey, that trek downstairs, if you know, the stuff up top is not appealing to you. So I mean, that's not in there yet. I mean, the basement thing, has that started popping off yet, or is it going to go somewhere down the line?
Well, I mean, we already started. I pulled, you know, I certainly pulled the first crate of titles that you know, I didn't want to get rid of, but I, you know, didn't necessarily need to keep out, because I knew there were things that over time people may ask for, especially as DVDs go out of print, and they tend to every, you know, 7 years or so. But I just didn't want to get rid of these titles. So yeah, we've got a few things in the basement right now, but it's not like we're going to make people crawl around in the you know, dank, dark place. Like, it's still going to be well organized. And we'll have everything available both in the computer and available on our website, so people can see that our inventory can increase even if our size can't.
Of course, we just have to ask, or at least I have to ask, I mean, just what made you want to do this in the first place? Because I remember when the first time I heard about this, it was kind of like this big project that you had going, where you even, didn't you have a Kickstarter page for this?
Yeah, we did an Indiegogo campaign. Well, I'll tell you, just going back to how it started, I've been a film journalist now for a great many years, and mm-hmm. I was programming for the Rerun Theater. And then, it turned out that my local video shop, which was also called Video 3 Brooklyn, the signs went up saying that the store was going to be shutting down and the liquidation sale was forthcoming. And about a week later, I mean, and this is a place that I use quite frequently. I mean, when I finally looked at my account, when I was finally behind the counter, I was able to see just how much money I had spent there, and it was a pretty penny. The signs had gone down, and the liquidation sale was off, and none of the employees seemed to really know what was going on. Mm-hmm. I had known the previous owner, Dan, for many years, and so it was essentially my wife who said, you should find out what's going on with this, because there was a rumor that somebody had thrown their hat in the ring to buy the place. industry was certainly going the way of the dodo, and I couldn't believe that somebody was going to want to purchase a place, especially if it was failing. So I got in touch with Dan at my wife's suggestion, and sure enough, it had nothing to do with it failing. In fact, the store was still sustainable, but he was living in Kentucky and wanted to start a new business venture. And it was from there I took the financial to my accountant and just worked up the math, and basically everything was pointing to the fact that if I was passionate about this endeavor, it was absolutely in my wheelhouse and something worth pursuing.
Yeah, it kind of reminds me, and I don't know if you know much about this, because you know Preston Miller?
Sure, absolutely.
Yeah, I remember a while back talking to Preston Miller, and he told me that he used to frequent this video store, a few years back, and it was a video store, and person who mostly manned the whole thing was Paul Nelson, the former Rolling Stone journalist and writer. And you're telling me this because I just got through reading that and actually reviewing that book of interviews he did with Clint Eastwood, Conversations with Clint, he ran a video store in New York, and they would talk about movies and everything. It just became like this big hangout, and I don't know if it's been that way for you yet, where you're getting regulars and talking about film with different people, and I don't know if you even, go about imparting your wisdom on potential cinephiles. I mean, just what is the day-to-day like for you?
I think all those things are absolutely true. Just to throw it on the side, we've got Preston's Last Movie Godsland is on our new release shelf right now, since Preston was kind enough to send me a copy of the movie. I absolutely see it as a hangout, and I think that's a large appeal of the place, is that it's a home for cinephilia. I absolutely have regulars, people I see every day, every week, people who, I don't need to know their phone number or their name to be able to look up their account right away, or people whose taste I'm so in tune with because I see what they've been renting, that I know how what to recommend to them based upon the things that are going to be their flavor. It's absolutely been a hangout. In fact, just today, a filmmaker friend of mine, Spencer Parsons, who lives in Chicago, but I met in Austin about 20 years ago, was in town and stopped by for the first time. And that's always exciting too, is to be able to, to show the place off to people who don't necessarily live in the area, and get them, starting to talk with my Brooklyn regulars as if they live here too.
Have you got a couch yet?
No, again, 375 square feet. There's not going to be a couch during business hours, but we had a contractor who was working with us named Ivan James, who unfortunately didn't finish the job and ran off with the last bit of money. So we're scratching together the last little bit we need to finish the store, which would mean that the middle island of shelving is going to be movable, and that way that we can actually have screenings, and by summertime we'll be able to do that. So the couch idea is not off the table quite yet.
Well, I was just saying that because there's a video store in Raleigh that has this couch for some reason. I don't know, I rarely see people actually on the couch. I guess those are for the hangout people, but wait a minute, somebody ran off with all the money, with the rest of the money, and this dude is, you ever find this guy? Did you ever figure out what happened?
I did run into him once at a Home Depot, of all places, trying to chase him down in a rental car, but unfortunately weren't able to get him, so... these things happen. I've heard plenty of horror stories about contractors, and this guy had gone above and beyond in so many ways. Besides that, and the fact that that a good majority of the money was crowdsourced, meant that it's not a great thing, and it means that the store is just not quite finished yet. But we wouldn't have been able to move as far along as we have if it
chased him down in a rental car?
I was in a rental car, and because living in New York, my wife and I don't have a car, and we just happened to be going over to Home Depot to get some supplies for the store, and ran into this jerk.
And so what? He just. I mean, did he dash? Did he see y'all and just started running, or just when he ducked away?
Oh, no, we had a conversation, and the guy was sheepish, and he knew he was he knew he had messed this one up. But we're not worried about that so much. It's just getting the store finished, and we're lucky to have been as far along as we were. And that wouldn't have happened if we weren't able to raise as much money as we had.
Well, it's interesting talking to you about all this, because the first time I ever heard of you was when you were distributing films with Andrew Grant, another a person who's been on the podcast, and you distributed DVD independent films on DVD under the name Benton Films. And it's kind of funny talking to you now, since you're running a video store, since you seem to be one of these film writers who's kind of accepted that people, see movies at home, and you, in a way, you try to at least try to gear them in the right direction by either distributing the kind of films they should see or running a video store with films you think they should see. So, I mean, is that just a thing for you, just decide what you...
Well, that's nice of you to say. My work with Andrew Benton Films, that was a great opportunity, and I'm really proud of all the releases that we put out there. Benton we got into the DVD business just as the market was souring or at least reaching oversaturation, and it wasn't an easy thing for the kinds of films that we were really championing and wanted to get out there in a bigger and more meaningful way. I think there's certainly some DNA shared between why I was interested in working with Andrew with Benton, why I was interested in programming for the Rerun Theater, why I'm still a film journalist today, and why I also own a video store. I love turning people on to new stuff. That's for sure. And film culture has been such an important part of my life for so long that I can't even remember a time when it wasn't. And I feel like this is just one more opportunity for me to directly reach people. I mean, the thing is, writing about film, I certainly don't feel like it's harder to have a direct connection with people, because you write something, you turn in your copy, you work with your editor, and then it's in a magazine or on a website, and then maybe people read it, maybe they don't, maybe they comment, maybe they don't, and there's just kind of a remove, and it doesn't really have the same kind of directly satisfying feeling as when someone comes into the store and says, "We were talking about this movie, and I can't remember what it was, but it had this person in it, or it had this premise, or it was set here. Can you help me find that? Or hey, thanks for putting this in my hands. Or I love being schooled myself. I love when someone comes in and says, there's this movie, and I saw it years ago, and blah, 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 and I start, researching online right there and realizing, I know exactly what they're talking about, and I've never seen it. And, I find out a lot more about film from my customers than I would if I were just strictly a journalist. I think it's that relationship I have with the customers, and the fact that they're excited about this kind of analog experience, which seems so antithetical to our, increasingly technologically advanced society, where social media seems to really trump these one-on-one interactions. I mean, Brooklyn or any sort of metropolitan area is certainly going to have a different
forgotten people who just gets the facts all wrong with a movie, and because that's I've often had contact with those people, and that's you ever have people like it was about this thing starring this person, you know, that person on the TV, and he was with this girl, and they were doing something, and just, yeah, people like that just have trouble actually coming up with anything about the movie that would be useful to you, for you as information?
To an extent, sure, but I feel like I've been doing this long enough, and being in this role, you know, regardless of what the job description actually was, that, I love talking I love talking about film with people who are extremely savvy and those who only watch a few movies a year. Like I don't really differentiate there because I have different types of conversations and I kind of learn about the language of not just cinema but the language of talking about cinema. And I think I've got a pretty good idea of how to kind of pull those things out of people because even when they can't quite articulate what they're trying to say. Sometimes all it takes is a few leading questions to figure out what they're trying to say. And you know, when somebody's like that, when they're a little tongue-tied or just don't have the experience or vocabulary to talk about those things, but they still know what they want, or they know they have an idea of if something has been recommended to them or whatever. That's part of the fun and challenge too. Yeah, sure. I mean, that happens all the time. It's never. I have yet to be totally stumped by somebody coming in that we didn't at least have enough information that we can help with the, we can look it up with the help of old Google.
Well, let's take it all the way back here. You were talking about how you feel that there hasn't been a moment in your life where there hasn't been film. And so when did it all start for you, as I like to ask all the fellow guys who appear on the show?
I guess both my parents certainly like movies. I was born in Michigan and then my parents moved out to Southwest, to the suburbs outside of Phoenix when I was about four, and that's really where I was planted until about 20 years old when I finally moved to Austin and then New York not too long after that. I'd say my cinephilia really grew while I was living in Arizona and, not living in Los Angeles or Chicago or New York or, a place that had a lot of film culture necessarily. Video stores were certainly my way in, more so than TV, more so than the movie theaters. Video stores were what really allowed me to dig in. I think my way into cinephilia was through genre movies. I think horror movies and science fiction, but yeah, I think mostly horror. Growing up and doing the thing that interests a young boy, especially before girls were interesting. I think horror films really kind of grabbed me and showed me how much stranger and wilder and wonderful movies could be. And I guess it was as an early teenager when I finally discovered international cinema and realized that my mom was right all these years. Subtitles are not a bad thing. And I don't really know what the steps were from there. I mean, some things begat other things. I certainly knew about I knew about the movies of Alex Cox before I knew about the movies of Robert Bresson, but I think one certainly got to the other, even if they were some way, sometimes sideways glances.
At what age were you feeling the more upper echelon films, the foreign films, the great works, if you will?
Oh, if you want to talk about the absolute canon, anything that's being released by like Masters of Cinema or Criterion, I'd say I was probably about 15 when I really broke through to that. Mm-hmm. And it's been really exciting to me at the store to see kids who were younger than I was, who were living in a much more digital age, and where there's so many more works that are accessible at their fingertips, digging in. I love to see these teenagers coming in and seeing Akira Kurosawa films and things that I just did not even have access to, and I had to find in my own weird way and find my own weird friends who would also get me excited about things that were much smarter and edgier than I knew existed prior to that.
When did you decide to start writing about it?
I was never really conscious about that. I moved to New York in 2001, early 2001, and I was here originally as an illustrator and designer living in Austin, and a lot of my work was coming out of here, and I had an opportunity to come out to New York and really just fell in love with the city and moved out a few months later. And so I moved to Brooklyn in 2001, and then after the economy just took a dive post 9/11, I started working at the local video store. Believe it or not, which is funny because that was in Carroll Gardens, which is not too terribly far from where Video Free Brooklyn is now. And in fact, I even remember in 2002 I was working at that store, which was called it was a little hole in the wall called in fact Hole in the Wall Video, which is no longer there. And I took a part time job there and put a little extra utilities money in my pocket and started managing the place and taking some of the things that I learned from great video stores over the years, especially Vulcan Video and I Love Video, both in Austin, and turned that place around and made it more profitable than it had been in about 15 years. I'd even gotten the impetus at one point to start a video store, which is how I met Andrew Grant many, many moons ago, but that was just as the industry was starting to fade away, and it just didn't seem like a worthwhile investment today. I realize I'm getting off topic here, but I do want to go ahead.
Well, it just seems like, in all the time I've been doing this podcast, I've just never heard a person's life story more tied together as it is with yours, because it just seems like your entire life has been surrounded by video in some fashion, and it just seems to always find its way back. It's the one thing you know the most about, which is, whether or not, of course, because I was going to start asking about Benton Films, and just how did that start, and of course, how did that end?
You can't say Benton necessarily ended. It's dormant. Andrew's living in Berlin these days, and that alone makes it much harder. But the market's market is just so cooked, it's so difficult, and I know there are a lot of great boutique companies out of there, and I know a lot of the distributors personally, and it ain't an easy fight for most of them. And they're lucky to get their stuff out there in any sort of big way. Benton's not done, but it's we're just not doing anything. Andrew right now has been producing a film, and I'm doing these things here. So we've talked about it every once in a while about how Benton could come back. But I think if it does, it's going to be in a different incarnation. I think you're right. I think movies and video have certainly been such a huge part of my life. And it's weird because movies have not been, my primary source of entertainment escape. I think I use music and live music more for that. But movies have certainly, I don't know. I think that's a bigger, bolder conversation than what we probably have time for here. But yeah, they've absolutely been at least the one guiding star that has led me down some fascinating paths that I'm proud to have taken.
Well, it doesn't have to be a bigger, bolder conversation. We can just try and see. We can summarize it up at some point. What is it about movies for you, apart from It is obviously it's kind of something that you understand in not only as a person who enjoys film and who appreciates it, but knows how it can be distributed, whether it be distributing it through video or programming like you did at Rerun, or having a video store and passing along to potential renters and everything. I mean, you seem to have the thing I'm getting mostly is that the thing is, you like to bring about a sense that you like to get with people and tell them about film. And so I'm getting a lot of sense that you like that interaction with people, and therefore you want a lot of that is just imparting wisdom and just bring about a sense, almost a communal sense, where it's you want to invite people in to feel about film the same way you do.
Yeah, well, I think part of that is true. I don't think it's necessarily about me or wanting to impart any wisdom so much as just wanting to hear my passion and get people excited about things that they may not know exist. I mean, if it's not up their alley, fine. There's plenty of things that people tell me are absolutely fantastic that just haven't engaged me. But that doesn't mean they shouldn't exist or that I think they're not worthwhile. It's just, to each their own. But I don't even think it's necessarily the medium of film. I think what it is about film to me is that it's such a, I think it's the arts that really excite me. And within film, you can have so much of the arts. You can have music and painting and sculpture and performance and architecture. You can have anything that is created, in all sorts of mediums, all combined into one. But I think the through line for me is not even so much those mediums or a combination of mediums as it is storytelling. As much as I love experimental filmmaking, and I do, and I really do, I think storytelling is what excites me most. I love to tell stories. I love to be told stories, and I love to share stories that have been told to me. And I think film is a medium that really allows me to do it. And I think this wacky career path that I've had has also allowed me to do it. But more than anything, it's all been inspirational to me to want to make more movies, which is what I'm gearing up to do later this year and hopefully in years to come.
Well, I mean, we'll talk about the filmmaking side of your life, but also real briefly, because for those who have not seen much of the films and been in the Benton Films library. And this is something I was wondering about, because a lot of the films that, most of the films that you and Andrew distributed through Benton, it unfortunately had the, fell for, as for a lot of people would say, in the mumblecore genre. And I didn't know if that was such a thing that you appreciated, having this, your business being referred to as that's the DVD distributor that distributes all the mumblecore films.
Well, you are literally the first person to ever say that to me.
Okay.
there was something. First and foremost, let me just deconstruct that. The mumblecore it's been this backhanded term that I think was used for a while to describe movies made at a certain point, made at a certain time, that happen to have a shared social and artistic network of people.
Mm-hmm.
I think really when people don't even realize it, but when they said mumblecore, they really meant a film directed by Joe Swanberg at a certain point in his career. Because I think with the kind of movies that Joe makes now, you wouldn't necessarily call that. There was never a genre. It wasn't a movement. It certainly wasn't an aesthetic. It was just an inevitable thing that happened when digital filmmaking making low-budget movies, met each other at film festivals, started working on each other's movies, and then what became, what was a joke in one single interview, unfortunately caught on because it just had a catchy name to it. But, you know, we definitely distributed the first movie we ever did with Joe's LOL, which I still think is one of his finest films, his second feature. We also did Aaron Katz's first two features, which I think are quite different than what Joe made. And we also did Constructor Obli's first movie, Team Picture.
Yeah.
Beyond that, you know, The Guatemalan Handshake was shot in 35mm and does not feature 20-somethings talking on a couch.
Mm-hmm.
It features an old man and a little girl, and it's a very, very peculiar kind of ensemble piece. The Good Times Kid, I think, has more in common with the films of Jacques Petit and Jim Jarmusch than it does with the Swanberg or Andrew Pajolsky. That was never a stigma for us. I mean, at the time that we were putting out those films, it wasn't. That word hadn't even really caught on yet. It was just a cheap way for journalists to kind of hang, lazily hang all these movies on the same book. But they weren't really. I don't really think they have a whole lot in common other than the fact that they didn't cost a lot of money to make.
Yeah.
You certainly can't say about The Free Will, our 3-hour German epic drama about a rapist trying to keep the beast within. Ain't nothing mumbly about that, I'll tell you what.
Oh, okay. Well, you know, you mentioned Aaron Katz. I've often found myself being a big fan of his work. Like, I do have the release he had, which was Dance Party USA in Quiet City. That was like a twofer that you guys released. Because he's from North. He studied film here in North Carolina, and so I. You know, when that came out, I actually think, there was this Valentine's Day spread in the newspaper that I was working for at the time, and, you know, everybody was drawing up lists about their favorite films, and I said, well, why don't y'all just watch this, because they're movies about relationships that seem real and shit like that, and, or at least a different approach on, you know, the romantic film or whatnot. And so even though like Aaron has been kind of, I think I've spoken to Aaron, interviewed him a time or two, where he's kind of fallen in that whole genre of guys with like Swanberg and Bujalski and all them. He does do very interesting films, and I often find even when he did Cold Weather, his third film. There are those that, as you said, that you distributed films that were very interesting and very different, and seeing the films that he did was very eye opening to me, I would say.
Oh, I'm glad you enjoyed that release. I mean, that was certainly one of my favorites, and I was really really proud to have been a part of that, because I think Aaron continues to grow. I mean, you know, we released his first two films, and I think he's only getting better with each one. I mean, I think Cold Weather is so far his best feature, and it's only going to go up from there. I mean, look, it's life, it's experience, and all these filmmakers. I mean, I just saw Joe's new movie at South by Southwest, and mm-hmm. that was a grand new leap forward for him as well. And it's neat to see a guy who used to make these small little films that you can, crank out very quickly, and he still does make films quite prolifically. But to see him working with a bigger budget and name actors and a more experienced cinematographer, and still not betray his own sensibilities, and still make a film that is very, very much true to what the reasons why he makes films. That's exciting. That's true growth, and not what you ordinarily see when a young filmmaker, finally gets their big break and gets a bunch of money and makes a compromised effort that doesn't look like their earlier work.
Mm-hmm.
I think all these guys are going to continue to grow, and I think we just happen to catch some of their films, and we're in a place where we were able to put them out
Want to talk about Rerun real quickly?
Sure. What's to say? I was offered a great opportunity in 2010 when a filmmaker friend of mine, Keith Bearden, just happened to be inside the Dumbo, the area in Brooklyn, a gastropub called Rebar, and found out that the owner was building a 60-seat multiplex, or a micro-cinema, I guess I should say, with a full bar and stadium-style minivan seats and a pretty kick-ass AV system. Guy didn't know what to do with it, and I came in and told him a few ideas of what I would like to see do with it, and we ran with it. And so for a good 2 years, I cherished the opportunity. It was great to be able to support all these independent films that mostly I had seen on the festival circuit, films that may have been a little too out there or too commercially unfamiliar with other things that have already been out in the commercial marketplace, and be able to give them a full week run and have them reviewed in the New York Times, the Village Voice, and Variety every week. It's a great opportunity to basically do a sort of DIY distribution, but from the position of an exhibitor. I certainly gained a lot of experience, and there were highs and there were lows, and unfortunately, I didn't feel terribly supported by the management, and which wasn't exactly their fault. I mean, there was nobody else there who knew anything about movies. It was a restaurant owner I was working for. So even though we had great success and got amazing press for both the films and the theater itself, I decided after last summer, after I'd already taken over Video Free Brooklyn, that it was just time to go. That I couldn't really get any more experience out of that, and I still program for a festival, at least one festival regularly, down your way actually in Wilmington, North Carolina, called Kookaloris. Yeah. But I just couldn't do it in that capacity anymore. It just wasn't worth my time, and I didn't feel like I could do anything more for the filmmakers or the audiences.
Yeah, well, it was an interesting project when I heard about it, because it's, just it was the Rerun Gastro Pub Theater combination, micro cinema, bar, food, palace. It was an interesting combination of things, and just like, it's one of those things where it can be a successful thing, or it can, as it happened, kind of end, and it's usually one or the other here. It's just like it was something seemed very ambitious at the time, and just like, so I see that.
It was definitely ambitious. It was nothing if not ambitious. I mean, I was having to be a one man show there, and it wasn't because I was trying to take control of things so much as there wasn't anybody else there who could do it. We didn't have an in house publicist, and I was still a full time journalist at the time while doing that job. Mm-hmm. So, I had to be the liaison and send out the press releases to the editors. Mm-hmm. But at the same point, I couldn't push too hard other than just promoting the fact that we had these movies. I couldn't really push for press because they would have potentially gotten into a stickier position since I was writing for some of the outlets that I was hoping that the films would get covered in. So it was more of just giving an opportunity for the filmmakers, almost like being, that they were musicians and I had a band, if I had a venue, and saying like, okay, what's your mailing list like? Because this opportunity is only going to be as good as you make it. Mm-hmm. And that at times was the best I could do, even though I hustled hard to try to get people to come see the movies. I mean, there were some of my favorite movies there were also some of the most poorly attended. And vice versa, things that I thought we'll be lucky if we get a few people out here, ended up being some of the biggest hits. So I definitely learned a lot about theatrical exhibition and the fact that there are so many variables that go into place, that it's not just about the content, the programming itself. Mm. That there are so many other factors above what brings in a crowd on a Friday night.
What did you take with that? What were the things you learned most?
Well, some of those I'd say are trade secrets that I certainly carry over to other aspects. I'd say the main thing is that you need to have a hook with pretty much anything. It doesn't matter how good a movie is. You know, you kind of just have to find how something rubs up against the zeitgeist, whether it be on a large scale, like, you know, the fact that Spring Breakers is playing at 1,100 theaters, so it still kind of blows my mind. But also just, you know, just knowing, like, what's coming out. You know, when Valentine's Day came around, I was very excited that IFC Films, who was never going to give a theatrical release to their film, Lovers of Hate, Brian Poyser's movie that I thought made a perfect kind of anti-Valentine's Day, anti-rom-com. And we had a nice little run with that. Anytime that you can bring some sort of live, you know, experience into it, that was always great. When we showed the Fishbone documentary, and on opening night, we sold out two screenings and had to add a third one at 1 a.m, because Angelo and Norwood from Fishbone were out there, skronking on the saxophone and doing their show. We once had a live stunt that went horribly awry when Chad Holtz, the subject of the documentary called Total Badass, that we played on a double bill with the filmmaker Bob Ray's Hell on Wheels, threw himself in a garbage can down the front stairs of Rebar and played dead for about 45 minutes, in which case the cops, the firemen, and the paramedics were all called. That was stressful in the moment, but the next day when I found out I wasn't fired, and that the owner was actually quite happy with the way it had turned out, I realized just the, you know, the importance of value and showmanship, and I think that really is something that filmmakers need to think about a lot when they're not just when they're making their movies, but also when they're trying to get it out there in the festival circuits and getting as many eyes on it as possible.
Yeah, it's strange because I'm looking at the website and they still got the Rerun website, and they still got. Apparently have stuff shows going on, and just
yeah. Well, after I left, they shut it down for a little bit, and then IFP, who actually works in the same building, they offered to take over the programming. So now I think they're still just in a trial period. So I don't know if it's working out for IFP, but I do like that organization, and they had some fine films, and I'm hoping it's working out for both them and the filmmakers.
Okay. Well, hopefully, maybe one day you'll be able, if this is still around, to play some of your films. You see, I like how I segued into that. I found out a lot about your filmmaking side, and one film which you did with your wife who runs Video Free Brooklyn with you, I believe. You did a film called Fish Kill Flea, which is about a flea market, which used to be a very popular mall back in the day. Now it seems to be this run-down place, and I believe that played in South by Southwest a few years ago. And I just wanted to talk about how that project came along.
Fish Kill Flea was a film that my wife Jennifer Lomer, who is not yet my wife, and my dear friend, a very talented guy named Brian Cassidy, who now makes movies with his wife, Melanie Shafsky. They had a couple films out there on the festival circuit this past year called Francine with Melissa Leo, and a documentary called The Patron Saints. And Melanie certainly helped out on the film too. But yeah, the three of us, Brian, Jennifer, and I, we Brian and Jennifer at the time were strictly photographers. Brian was going to the School of Visual Arts, the grad program for photography. I was already a film journalist, and we went upstate one fall to just to go look at the fall foliage, And Brian used to live in the area and told us about this old dead mall, the old Duchess Mall on Route 9 in Fishkill, and how the space hadn't been used in the mall in a great many years, but this ragtag flea market community had kind of set up shop in one tiny end in the old service merchandise, both indoors and on the parking lot. And he'd always tried to kind of capture what it was that was both somewhat depressing but also magical about the place. I mean, mm-hmm. It was like it was so run down, it was so low rent, and yet once you got there, you kind of didn't want to leave. There was just something truly, truly eccentric and wonderful about the place. And he was never able to really capture that feeling in photography. So we found out from the big cigar smoking owner Bill that they were going to finally raise the mall and turn it into a Home Depot. And we thought, well, geez, maybe we should try to capture this in film. So since Brian was going to SBA, he was able to get his hands on camera equipment. And what we thought originally was going to be a short film ended up getting longer and longer as these poor vendors were just giving the runaround. They didn't raise them for much longer than expected. So the vendors were trying to figure out, like, do they buy more product? Do they try to find another flea market? And because it was, you know, kind of low rent, there were plenty of people that were really on the balls of their ass and, you know, really needed the extra bucks that this weekend venture would have. And we just kind of wanted to get all that. We wanted to just document it before it wasn't there anymore. And everybody was really supportive. We went up there for several weeks and just started talking to people and interviewing them before we ever turned on any cameras, because we wanted to make sure that they were comfortable with us and that they were in line with what we wanted to make. And yeah, we had a great run with the film. It started, we premiered at South by Southwest in 2007, which was just after Andrew and I had picked up the rights for LOL, and Joe was there for Hannah Takes the Stairs, which was, you know, arguably the year that Mumble broke and Aaron Katz had Quiet City there, and that was the first time I saw that. And, you know, being able to be there as both a filmmaker and as a distributor was a pretty exciting experience. But as far as the film, the film had a nice run. We finished up a year and a couple months later. It's not exactly the most commercially viable thing. In fact, it would exactly the kind of movie that I would have programmed at rerun. So we haven't thought too hard about how we're going to get it out there, because that's not why we made it, and it wasn't. It was a very inexpensively made film, and pretty much a labor of love. Sooner or later, we'll probably, you know, give it away for free or figure out some sort of proper release that would do it justice. But this year, I'm finally ready to. You know, I've been doing all these odd jobs in film over the years, but I've always wanted to make more movies. So this is the year I believe it's going to happen. I'm working with a producer named Eric Opeka, who's co-writing a project with me right now, and we're hoping to shoot before the end of the year.
I mean, anything you can divulge about this particular film?
I can't, unfortunately. I'm actually contractually obligated to not say much, but I can tell you, I think it'll be very funny, and it will be a New York set movie, set in the near distant future, but about now.
And you'll be helming it?
Yeah, I'll be directing it and co-writing it, and Eric will be co-writing and producing.
Mm-hmm. I mean, as a person who has, as a film writer, film critic, film journalist who has taken that plunge, who has actually made that leap and say, you know what, I'm going to make movies. Just what have you found in your filmmaking experiences I'm just trying to see just that you do have this better sense of, you know, now things that you didn't exactly know when you were writing about film or even, you know, doing all the
yeah,
other things
absolutely.
You do as well?
I think that, you know, all these twists and turns of my career have all kind of benefited one another. I certainly learned from every one of these positions. I've learned both what to do and what not to do, and I've certainly made mistakes along the way and learned from those as well. I don't know if there's anything so tangible to be able to say, well, this is where I got this, this is where I got that. But I think all of these different hats I've worn, more than anything, have given me access to a lot of really fascinating people, and I think I've learned more from the people I've met than I have from necessarily just having these different roles. And I think a lot of those relationships and connections have certainly grown over time and helped me grow as both my artistic interests and just as a person in general.
Well, this is usually the part of the program where I ask the guest if there's any way they can people who are listening can contact you if they want to know more about your store or, you know, other things you've done.
Sure. Well, I'm out there in social media. I'm on Twitter as Cobble Hillis. It's a combination of my neighborhood of Cobble Hill and my last name Hillis. And the website, I think we did a pretty good job with it. It's called videofreebrooklyn.com.
Mm-hmm.
Which Video Free Brooklyn is also on both Facebook and Twitter. I'd say that's the best way, and I think how most people have gotten in touch with me. Or just stopping into the store. I'm usually behind the counter Mondays through Fridays, noon to at least 5 p.m., if not a little bit later. And, you know, just assuming I'm in town, I still go to a lot of festivals. I was just down at South by Southwest. I'm leaving soon for a couple weeks for the Sarasota Film Festival, and I leave directly from the Sarasota Film Festival to Off Plus Camera in Krakow, Poland, and that'll be in Cannes in May. So it's always go, but I'm not too terribly hard to track down.
Are you going to be in Poland for a festival?
I've got 4 days in Florida and then 4 days in Poland.
What's the Polish festival?
It's called Off Plus Camera.
Mm-hmm.
I've been hearing about it for years and been paying attention to their programming, which is really, really solid. And they've apparently got amazing crowds and of course the opportunity to be able to go to Poland as a guest. How can I possibly turn that down?
Mm-hmm. And Sarasota, what's making you go down to Sarasota to catch a festival?
Oh, Sarasota is where, you know, there's all these great regional film festivals that not a lot of people know. I mean, when we were first picking Fischio Flea out on the festival circuit, I wish someone had just sat me down and said, you know, besides Sundance, South by Southwest, Toronto, Cannes, all the ones that you know of, there are all these great festivals that nobody necessarily thinks about because they're not in they're not in ski country, or they're not in foreign regions people know. But whether it be the Sidewalk Festival in Birmingham, Alabama, Kukulores, which I mentioned, in Wilmington, North Carolina, Indy, Memphis, IFF Boston, the Maryland Film Festival in Baltimore is coming up soon. They're just these great festivals, and their programmers are going to these bigger A-list festivals. That's where they find some of their programming, and that's just where some of the true film community building is happening, and where a lot of these independent filmmakers are meeting each other and starting to then collaborate on their next project. So I'm going down to Sarasota. Tom Hall, who's been Big Bucky Muck down there, has exquisite taste. I knew him originally from he used to go to the Deer Film Festival. He had one of the IndieWire blogs and was writing about the festival for that. But he's got fantastic taste. Sarasota has been breaking a lot. time down there. I'm on the every other year track with them. Mm-hmm. This year I'll be covering it as a journalist for Movie Maker and I believe IndieWire.
Yeah, cause I was saying like you manage to go to these festivals because you are covering them, or are they like out of your pocket?
You know, sometimes I'm covering them. Sometimes the Polish Film Festival and they're guests. I go to Google Earth every year because I'm actually required to. I'm on something called the Ambassadors Council as well as the Trustees Board. Mm. And then others, I'm there as just as a guest. I do a lot of jurying for festivals. I'll be next jurying for the New York Friars Club Comedy Film Festival, which is coming up here, starting April 1st. And then I tend to jury every year at Sidewalk. So I'm coming to these festivals in different capacities, and some of them I've even been to as a filmmaker, but I definitely love film festivals, and I think some of the best films I see all year long are not coming out theatrically. They're at these festivals, because sometimes that's where the truly, truly bold cinema is. That's where the humble beginnings are, anyway.
So you like the way this turned out? Because it's funny, we didn't even get to talk much about film journalism, which, you know, I mean, I remember reading something, I believe, an interview you did on IndieWire, where you're talking about how you just always seem to get into dying fields, journalism and the film DVD distribution and all that. It's almost like it gets kind of this sense of romanticism with you when it comes to these things that you seem to hold so dear. Like you just like, you know, even though, you know, the tides may change culturally, you know, you seem to really still hold on to these things that basically made you the person that you are.
I would hold with a statement. The thing is, it's not like any of these things have, it's not nostalgia. It's definitely not nostalgia, and it's definitely not holding on to the past so much as just embracing the things that I'm passionate about. Mm-hmm. And, you know, if I see an opportunity, I certainly get my if I have any sort of entrepreneurial streak, I get that from my father, who, you know, when I was growing up, was running multiple companies at once. I think it's more of just I'm passionate about film, and if I see an opportunity where I think I can both make a difference and hopefully keep Amex on my back while I'm doing it, mm-hmm. I'm gonna go for it. I think living in New York has certainly been one of the greatest things of my life, and it's certainly first place I've ever lived that is, you know, felt homey enough that I can't see myself leaving here. But New York has just blessed me with so many opportunities, because there's so much going on, and, you know, some of them have worked out great, and we've talked about them in this little chat, and others haven't, and I just moved on to the next one when the time came. And I think the through line is just I love the arts and I love cinema, and if there's any way for me in whatever this career trajectory is to be able to, you know, try on something new and do something different, something that's going to excite me and potentially excite other people and you know, hopefully make a couple bucks doing it too. I'm going to take it. I'm certainly not getting rich off of any of these endeavors, but they've all been worth my time, shall we say?
Yes, and yeah. So this has definitely been worth my time. So I saw what I did. Yeah, never mind. I'm just trying to find a nice way to wrap this all up in a pretty bow. And I just want to say that thank you very much. This has, you know, been great talking to you about all this, and just like good luck with all your endeavors, which you seem to have a lot of, and just keep doing you, man.
I appreciate it, man. I appreciate your interest in these great little things I do. But viva la cinema is all I gotta say.
And well, thanks a lot, man. Let me close this out here real quick, as always. This is Craig D. Lindsay saying, I haven't had a good time since 1997. A year I remember because I wanted to get a Laserdisc player. I wanted to get, because like a Blockbuster Video I used to go to, they used to rent Laserdiscs and everything. Like I still want to see Laserdiscs for some reason, even though I don't know where the hell to find any anymore. But just anybody has like some Laserdisc and like a free Laserdisc player, maybe you can holler at a brother. Maybe we can work something out. So you don't sell laser. You don't have any Laserdisc, do you, Aaron?
I've gone the other way. It's all DVD and Blu-ray for me.
Ah, fuck. Well, I guess I'll keep moving on then.